Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. The English cricket season is nearly upon us. We're only 2 weeks away from the start of this year's county championship, but we've got plenty of international cricket to talk about before then. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of the Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine, Phil Walker. There's a new magazine out this week. England's monster tour of Asia is still going on. Since we last recorded a pod, it's not gone great for England. They lost the last two T20Is and the first ODI against India. Let's go in reverse chronological order. England lost the first game of the ODI series by 66 runs. It was a pretty good game. England were 135 for none, chasing 317 before collapsing to 251 all out. An emotional Kunal Pandya hit the fastest ODI half century by a debutant, beating Roland Butcher's record.
Amazing.
Which lasted a very long time. And another debutant, Prasidh Krishna, took a fourfer as well. Joe, how did England mess that up? It looked like England were going to cruise home.
Well, they messed it up by playing the way they play, as Owen Morgan was keen to emphasise at the end. And it is hard to criticise them for that, given it's won them a World Cup. But you do think there's perhaps a little bit of room for nuance within that when you're so far ahead of the rate that you can tone it down slightly. I think Morgan said he'd much rather lose by 60 runs playing like that than 20 runs and playing differently. And you can see where the logic is. It's so fundamental to the way that team plays and the success they've had that he doesn't want to change it. So you can understand to extent. I think obviously Joe Root at three is a huge loss, and the fact that Stokes at three, which should be quite a good option, Stokes just isn't in any kind of form. So that really did weaken the side. And then that kind of middle order of Billings, Moeen. I mean, they batted down to 10, but it just didn't really feel like they had the players in form to grab the game by the scruff of the neck and take them over the line. And I think we also saw in the bowling department that when Jofra Archer isn't there, that he kind of papers over a lot of the cracks in that England bowling lineup. Any side in the world would hugely miss him. But I think we saw that very clearly, particularly at the death yesterday.
England were so good and still are so good at ODI cricket. You kind of forget how many runs 320 is. So even after Bairstow and Roy have a start like that, there is still 200 runs to go. And Root so often would get runnable 70s, runnable 100s, whatever, and people kind of go, well, after that start, wasn't too difficult. But actually, it's quite difficult. And I kind of think that a lot of people leapt on Owen Morgan's comments after the game. But I think India deserve a lot of credit because Stokes didn't get out trying to blast it. He was 1 off 9, 1 off 10 or whatever. India actually bowled pretty well in the middle.
Yeah, they did, and they pulled it back beautifully, really. In the cold light of day, if you're 130 for naught off from about 5 minutes of an innings, then, you know, it's one hell of an achievement to lose by 60 odd, which is a decent defeat. You know, this is not an arse nipper one way or the other. Stokes at three is a tricky one because Stokes is not an especially natural manoeuvrer in the early part of an innings. Stokes is obviously, you know, combustible and pyrotechnic towards the end of an innings once he gets himself in, but he's not a natural nudger and nerdler in the way that Root is. I mean, Root's born just to angle it down to third man in a one-day game, and as we all know, you know, he's 40 off 40 without anyone noticing. That's all that was required yesterday, but there was a frenetic nature, or frenetic element to Stokes' innings, I thought, and it wasn't quite there on the drive, and his feet weren't quite there, which speaks of a bloke who's not in the best of form at the minute. As ever, whenever England play a game of cricket, there is that tendency to make grand statements about their philosophy and about something that's gone profoundly wrong. Nothing's gone profoundly wrong here. But what it might be is quite a useful reminder that there are different ways to do this thing. And they learned that in the World Cup, going through the World Cup, that beforehand it had been, you know, like, this is how you do it. Like, you know, they're a big punching team. You know, they're George Foreman in the middle of the ring. Well, the reality is that you come up against different opponents in different conditions and different circumstances, and you do have to think on your feet a little bit, and you do have to dance a little bit. And they learnt that during the World Cup. This is just a useful reminder. And the cycle begins again. Talking of Stokes, that was his first game since that final, right? So, and how long? The best part of 2 years ago now. So, yeah, I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with England's approach. As ever, Morgan's logic is pretty sound, I think. But there are always things that they can develop and that they can sharpen up. And I think having a route reserve for number three is something that they do have to consider. Milan was in the squad, albeit a kind of reserve floater, if you like. Livingston was also in the squad. I'm not sure if he's really a three in 50 over cricket. But Milan, you would think, would be a three in 50 over cricket. And the concerns that people have about Milan in 20 over cricket, that he eats up too many balls initially in his innings, well, that's not quite as big a problem if you're batting three in a 50 over game. And the tempo that he plays at would have suited that team, I think. No one will ever gazump Root at three. He's the complete player at three. But they do need some other alternatives as well.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that given that Milan looks to be central to England World Cup, T20 World Cup plans, and he's not played a whole amount of cricket in India, it's also not a guarantee that he's actually going to play a lot in the IPL. I thought with Root not in the ODI squads, you know, England don't really lose anything from having Milan play three ODIs against India at the back end of the tour.
Looking at the setup of that 11 as well, I'd be surprised if that's the same 11 that they play in games two and three in this series, because that middle order is flimsy, you know, or it's raw, and it's certainly lacking in cricket as well. Billings, Moeen, Sam Curran, 6, 7, 8, and that's your engine room really in a 50 over game. And I think they might need to look at that. My instinct is that I would bring Milan in and I would move Stokes down, or I would leave Stokes at three, but I would bring Livingston in.
Livingston's due a game, isn't he? He's done a lot of bench warming. There's also more room for experimentation because we haven't got a 50 over World Cup just around the corner. When those games aren't kind of slipping by in the way they are for T20. What I found really interesting is to watch two ODI sides play in completely different ways. And I think that it's interesting when we talk about we shouldn't criticise England too much for playing that way, because India do almost the reverse, where they're very sedate at the start and they back themselves to catch up at the end. And we and lots of people have been critical of India for not getting 350 plus because of playing that way. And yesterday could have been an example. If England had actually made the most of that good start, they could have chased down India's total quite reasonably, easily. And we'd have been saying, well, why didn't India get 350, 360? Because the way they batted for the last 15 showed that they could get there. As it happened, England collapsed, and it looks like the way England play is the wrong way to play, and India have nailed it. But it's just down to who does it most often in a successful way. And England have been that team over the last few years. It just didn't come off yesterday.
Yeah, I thought yesterday as well, India were on for a much, much bigger score. England had a really good five-over spell from about the 35th, 36th over. Yeah. Otherwise, I think India could have got a massive score. One positive, I guess, for England was Johnny Bairstow's inning, 66 ball, 94. He looked like he was on for 160, 170 at one stage. I had a few messages from some of my mates yesterday going like, is Bairstow England's best ever ODI player? And I was thinking, no, he's not. Butler or someone like that. But then you look at the numbers and it is, they are freakish. And I think we kind of forget it because he's had quite a weird career. 74 tests in and out of the test side for a year. He's one of England's best batsmen. Struggled for the last couple of years. In T20 cricket, he's a brilliant opener, brilliant in the middle. But in ODI cricket, since he came into the side in 2017, his numbers are ridiculous. He averages over 50 at the top of the order with a strike rate over 100. He's the only opener in ODI history to do that. The only other to average over 40 and with a strike rate over 100 is Jason Roy, actually. Only Rohit Sharma scores hundreds more regularly at the top of the ODI order than Bairstow. Roy and Bairstow as a pair reach 50, one in every two innings they play. They have 1,200 partnerships in 42 innings, which is a rate better than any pair ever.
Just say, listeners, that Yaz isn't even looking at his screen as he's reeling off those stats. Those are just ingrained in the brain. Very impressive.
I mean, you were scurrying through our laptop. I'm literally keep up.
But I guess because he was almost like the last ingredient added to that batting order in the run-up to the 2019 World Cup, and things were going pretty well before then. But do we appreciate enough just how ridiculous Bairstow is at ODI cricket in particular?
No, we don't, and we didn't even during the World Cup. Take it back to that time. They had to win 4 in 4. Bairstow had a pretty kind of indifferent start to the tournament. He got a first bowler here, didn't he, to kick the tournament off. They needed to win 4 in 4. It was desperate scenes. They'd lost 3 out of 6, I think it was. And he went 100-100 across 3 or 4 days. You know, one against India, one against New Zealand, and then that was that. And then careered into the semi-final, and the rest is history. And yet again, in the shakedown of that World Cup, when you come to look at it, people kind of forget that, really. It's partly, I think, a symptom of the Bairstow enigma. It's partly that he has so many faces in this England setup, and some of them work, and some of them look right, and some of them don't. But if you just take this in isolation as an ODI opening batsman, he is unquestionably the best since Triscothic that England have had, and will in the end eclipse him. I think certainly his record will. There is a selflessness to his game which I really like, and this is Morgan's great legacy. Nobody plays for themselves anymore. And that certainly wasn't the case in previous generations. And you see that with Bairstow. The one thing I would add here, in the context of how brilliantly he played yesterday, and it was certainly wasn't his fault that England lost the game. However, when you get to 90 and 65 balls, and you've had a bit of a stutter, and you've lost two or three quickly, and there is a deep mid-wicket, and you are winning the game, just another 45 minutes of your control wins you the game. Do you need to try and play that shot? Do you need to try and take that bloke on? Now, this is where it comes back to the philosophy of this is the way that we play. And as I stress again, it was not his fault that they lost this game. But when you look at these kind of clinch, hit these big moments, clutch moments, that was significant in the story of this innings. The days of batting through are gone because now it's all wild and
beautiful. For England, at least.
For England. But there's also a small point to make about reading the game situation. And if Bairstow had throttled back a little bit, and he has done that as well in the past in ODI cricket, if he'd throttled back a little bit, taken some of the sting out of that moment, got to his 100, moved on to 120, at maybe just a run a ball from there on in, he's still a run, excuse me, a run a ball to 120 is still a 90 ball 120, right? So by no means am I putting the boot in here. His innings was outstanding and he's an outstanding ODI player. But there is, in the pressure cooker, there is a point to be made there.
So on the question of whether he is England's greatest white ball cricketer, we actually had an interesting letter into Wisden Cricket Monthly last month because Owen Morgan had described in an interview to me in the previous issue, Joss Butler as a one-off. And the person who wrote in, who I can't remember their name, unfortunately, but made the very reasonable point, well, is Butler a one-off? Hang on, you've got someone in the side who was doing something just as extraordinary, different batting position. And I think you can throw Root into the conversation as well. I think Root, Bairstow, Butler are all very much up there as England's greatest ever white ball batsmen, but they all just do different jobs. I think it's very hard to say one is better than the other because they all do what they do fantastically well. I guess the argument you could make with Butler, I think if you shoved Butler up to open in ODI cricket, he'd have a pretty extraordinary record as well. We'll never see if that's the case or not, but that's what I suspect, having seen what he does in T20 cricket. Whereas Bairstow and Roots is a perhaps more specialist role, that's definitely where they're best placed. I think Butler just looks like he can do it all. But then we do, more often than we should, we come back to kind of Bairstow v Butler in different types of cricket and in different roles. And we should probably just appreciate that we've got both of them rather than kind of matching them up against each other.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if... Well, Bairstow for a while has insisted that he doesn't want to be a white ball specialist. And I wonder if that kind of plays into our perception of him. There's like this frustration around Bairstow as someone who still wants to play test cricket, even though he hasn't quite got the returns in recent years. But actually, just if you just separate it, like look just at the white ball output in the last 3-4 years, it's up there with the very best in the world.
I think it's also partly the opening partnership he has with Roy. They've been so much a pair that actually to talk about Bairstow as the best of the lot doesn't necessarily fit with that narrative. Now, what we've seen recently is that Roy hasn't been able to be as consistent as he was in the lead up to the World Cup and when he came back in after he'd had an injury in that World Cup, whereas Bairstow just keeps on going. And I think he is the senior, he's the better player of the two, I think, who you back to come good more often.
Yeah, just on the game yesterday, I thought India did quite well to starve Bairstow of the strike when Stokes came in. And then I think when Morgan came in as well, there's quite a long period where Bairstow barely faced a ball. So maybe that shot stemmed from a frustration, just not facing much.
I've got a question for you, Yaz. You tweeted something yesterday, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Tell our hordes of army of listeners what you tweeted.
I tweeted something along the lines of ODI cricket
is rubbish.
Is by some distance my least favourite format, which doesn't mean I don't enjoy it. Just means relative to the other two.
That's nowhere near hysterical enough for Twitter. You've got to slam it. You can't just say it's my least favourite. That's not social media.
There was a safety in the tweet in that ODI ultras don't really exist. Like, if you said that about Test cricket or T20I cricket, you get a lot of very shouty people.
And also, we know how much you love the other two, so you're not really slamming it too much.
So come on then, spill the beans. Why?
Part of the reason why people in England have really enjoyed it for the last 5 years is because of how good England is. I think England have been for 5-6 years. I think that you get quite long periods which almost feel like, you know, in Test cricket where teams feel like they need to catch up with the over rate a little bit, and you get a few overs of off spin that doesn't really, when not much is really happening, there's not really much of a battle between bat and ball. I think you do get that quite a lot in the middle overs of ODI cricket still. I know the game's changing a little bit. I think that in T20 cricket, I like the, it's more fresh as a format, still evolving quite a lot. So you get new tactical ideas come into place, and the way in which people play is changing quite quickly. And as a result, the format is more interesting. If you're just comparing the two, I still enjoy ODI cricket, but I don't know. I think also part of it is growing up, there was just so much ODI cricket that was just the same. So you just had like 2-2-5 plays, 2-45. I know it's not quite like that anymore, but I guess it was always like way, way below Test cricket for me. And as T20 cricket has become more and more professional and taken more and more seriously, that's gone past it.
Joe?
I would say it probably is my least favourite of the three, but not by much, just a little bit. And also the 50 over World Cup was, I think I just kind of deal in World Cups. T20 is the one round the corner, so that's what I'm kind of most excited by. But no, I think there's something, certainly from the kind of rhythms of working and following cricket, I much prefer an ODI, because a T20 is kind of, it's hard to work and cover it, and it's gone. Whereas an ODI, there is a rhythm to it in a way that you get with a day's Test cricket that I still like. And as a spectator sport, I still think 50 over cricket, if you're at the ground, is a brilliant day. You get a proper day's cricket, you get a result at the end of it. I think that's right up there. And sometimes with a day's Test cricket for me, depending on what that day of Test cricket offers. Whereas T20 as a spectator experience is great in a different way, but it's been and gone before you know it, really.
Yeah, I'm definitely not slagging it off. I still enjoy watching it. Just compared to the other two, I don't enjoy it quite as much.
You're Test ODI T20, are you?
Well, obviously, the five-day game's out there on its own. There's the line in The Wire by Poot, the world going one way, people another, and I am the people in that equation. I still retain a deep respect for 50-over cricket, and a deeper respect for that than I do 20-over cricket. And you talk about these world events. I think as a sporting feat to pull off a 50-over World Cup win is a deeper and more substantial sporting achievement than to pull off a 2-week 20-over jamboree, when you can peak at the right time, or someone can do something outrageous, or Marlon Samuels can play the innings of his life, or whatever it might be. Whereas if you win a 50-over World Cup, then you've earned every single bit of that. I just think it's a deeper and more substantial game. And also weirdly sturdy. You know, 1971 was, I think, the first game, a kind of accidental game played by England and Australia when the Test match had got washed out and all of that. And it's been written off routinely for the best part of 50 years, well, exactly 50 years. And yet I still think it's an evolving game. And while the formulaic element of 50 over cricket, I can see that. There's formulaic elements to all sport, I think, and there is formulaic elements to 20 over cricket. There is still, I think, an evolution of technique and theory in 50 over cricket, which maybe I wouldn't have said with as much confidence 6 or 7 years ago, for example. And just talking of that era, incidentally, about English cricket, I remember I spoke to two very prominent, very successful England cricketers, and it would have been 2013, and both of them were at the time in the 50 over team, and both of them, it was a bit earlier than that, it was 2012, it was. They were both in the England ODI team at the time and couldn't stand 50 over cricket, and they both told me that, independent of each other, off the record, they just couldn't stand it. Had no interest in it. T20 was taking over the world. They still cared very deeply about Test cricket. 50 over cricket was an inconvenience to them, and they were in the team at the time. I don't think their position was particularly unusual.
No, they were in a pretty dire English team at sure. the time who played really boring ODI cricket.
Sure, but as fans, you'd kind of think, well, try and invest a little bit more sure, passion and concern into it.
All I mean is if they were playing under Owen Morgan, they might have felt a bit more energised by what they were part of.
Possibly. But I do think it was also indicative of the culture at the time. That this felt like a dying art in a way that I don't think it does it anymore.
A couple more things comparing T20I cricket and ODIs or T20 and 50 over cricket. I think in T20, I think it's much, much harder to be a very effective 50 over bowler, just because you need to be able to do quite a lot more. In T20 cricket, you can be like a power play specialist or a death specialist, and that's the majority of your overs can be fit into one category. It's quite hard for a seamer to actually be very good across the different phases in a 50 over game, and they will have to bowl in all three phases realistically in 50 over cricket.
Which is a feather in the cap for 50 over cricket, right?
But I think that makes T20 cricket more watchable almost because you have more bowlers who can have an impact, I think.
But also, you can also be a bowler in T20 cricket, and if you go at 8.5 and over and you're, you know, 4 overs, 1 for 36, then that's kind of okay. But if you extrapolate that kind of limited impact across 10 over spell in a 50 over game, then you become unpickable, unselectable. I'm not saying that there's not an immense amount of skill involved in bowling 24 balls in a game. And we're seeing T20 specialists more and more, and legitimately so. But I think to survive in international cricket as a 50 over cricketer requires just that little bit more. And it depends what people watch their sport for. We might watch it for pure entertainment in that respect. Nothing can touch T20 cricket. But people may want to watch it because of they want to see a kind of deeper expression of sporting brilliance or excellence. And I guess maybe that's where I come in on that debate.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But I kind of like the specific specialisation in T20 cricket as well, like players who have one very specific role and they absolutely nail it. I like the idea of batsmen nowadays who we'll get onto Surya Kumar Yadav later in the show.
What an innings.
No, exactly. But players who just like you bat 30 balls, you get as many runs as that 30 balls, and you're supposed to bat in the first half of the innings, then you've got the other guys to do the rest. I kind of like that.
Yeah. And yet you call 50 over cricket formulaic. I don't know where we stand there. Let's move on.
Well, let's move on to the... Well, just a little bit more on the ODIs first.
All right, let's just do some more of that.
It's worth saying that this is not a full-strength England side. Geoff Archer's back in the UK, nursing his elbow injury. Chris Wokes and Joe Root have been rested, which means opportunities for others, namely some fringe bowlers, I guess, the Curran brothers, Moeen, and Reece Topley and Matt Parkinson, who haven't played yet this series, who I'm sure will later on. That is a hard Indian batting lineup to come up against if you don't play that much international cricket. Dharwan, Sharma, Kohli, Lancashire's Shreyas Iyer, who unfortunately is out of the rest of the series in the first half of the IPL.
What a coup by Lancs.
That is unbelievable signing. I want to read a long article on how that came
together.
I'd also
like to know what they're saying in the 100 war rooms as well. Yeah. When Lancs have picked him for the 50 over comp.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Looking
work.
Forward to the Lancashire streaming numbers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gonna get that. On Tom Curran in particular, he only played one of the T20s. He bowled 2 overs and went for 26. He played in the ODI, the first ODI of the series. His recent record isn't that great. He was part of the 2019 World Cup winning squad, obviously, but didn't play. He played Test cricket a few years ago. Barely played first-class cricket since because of his IPL gigs, even though he doesn't often play in the IPL. And he's had a really tough winter. He was the most expensive overseas bowler in the IPL, who played more than one game, went over 11 and over this winter in the T20Is, and has taken just one wicket in his last 9 ODIs. I thought he bowled okay yesterday, but I almost see that as being like as good a day as it really gets for Curran at the moment. Joe, what do you think's happened to Tom Curran? A few years ago, when he took that 5 for in Australia, there was a sense that this was a guy who's going to be really central to England's plans over the next few years in white ball cricket. And England have put a lot of time into him, but he's not really progressed as a player. And I'm sure he will have better days than he's had recently. But yeah, that progression has not really been there.
It hasn't. I mean, I wonder, he did have some impressive performances for England. He has done. I wonder if he was perhaps fast-tracked a bit too quickly, or perhaps his reputation perhaps exceeded his ability or his potential. You certainly see opposition sides now target him. You really notice that in T20 cricket. And I think once you get that sort of tag on your head, as it were, that you're the bowler to target in an attack, it becomes really difficult, especially if you're in this England side in the T20s bowling on the same side as Jofra Archer, who we know they're not going to necessarily go after in the same way. You know, when Tom Curran comes on, right, this is it. They're going to try and hit as many runs off this four overs as they can. And I thought he bowled fine yesterday, but I agree. I completely understand what you mean, that felt actually like quite a good day. And he went, it was none for 60-odd in the end. I can't help but feel there are probably better options, and certainly options that are worth looking at ahead of him. I risk repeating myself, but Saqib Mahmood, as we talked about on last week's show, I'd absolutely be having him above Tom Curran at the moment to at the very least have a look. Rhys Topley, you've obviously got that left arm angle that I think he'll get a go in at least one of the next two ODIs. But I think what we've seen with England is, and we saw this in the lead-up to the World Cup and at the World Cup, Morgan really doesn't change his 11 unless he has to, very, very occasionally. So Tom Curran has been back up for so long that he's almost due this opportunity to play in the 11 because a position's opened up. But actually, in the meantime, I think players might have come along who are probably more deserving or might do a better job than him. It feels like a little like we're going through the motions of Tom Curran's getting his game time to see whether he's worth his spot or not. And I think there might be more pressing contenders outside of the group.
He won't mind this fact, but he's secured another IPL gig with Delhi Capitals, which means that he'll play next to no Red Bull cricket for Surrey in the first half of the season, at least.
Again, which is the third or fourth season that's happened.
Indeed. And I think that is quite key to his story, really. Because if you want proper longevity as a top class seamer, then you need to be able to flip from one ball to the other and one format to the other, and you risk, I think, as a bowler in particular, becoming sort of funneled or kettled, if you like, into one particular role, one particular dynamic, and if that starts to wobble a little bit, then it's hard to know exactly where you go. And with Curran, who began as a red ball bowler, took 7 for 20-odd, you know, albeit in Division 2 for Surrey.
Leading wicket taker in the country in 2015, I think, 2016.
Started his red ball career for Surrey with a bang. The concern would be, I think, if you're looking at him from a neutral's perspective, where's the body of work going to come from if you are increasingly just recognised as someone who's going to be a kind of backup third seamer, fourth seamer with a white ball here and there, hoping to get the nod if one or two of the bigger hitters are unfit or rested or whatever. In an ideal world, you want a broader body of work than he's currently able to show or build upon.
Do you think bowlers who kind of break through, who have like quite distinctive slower balls, do you think they have quite a short shelf life?
Hold on.
got there eventually. At the very top level, that there is kind of something novel about them initially, but batsmen, once they've faced them a few times, kind of get used to it, pick the variations better.
I think that's definitely true. I think we can probably all think of examples. Pat Brown would be one who burst onto the scene in the T20 Blast, took loads of wickets with that knuckleball. He's had lots of injury problems since, but also hasn't been quite as effective as he's played. Other players that burst onto the scene, I'm sure there Andrew Tye was another one who had quite sustained success over a couple of years, but now seems to be quite expensive more often than not.
Dernbach.
Yeah, another good example. So yeah, I think that has to be the case. And bowlers always talk about the fact they need to keep evolving, but I mean, it's difficult to keep evolving. I mean, at some point you reach the limit of your skills, or you can't, how many different types of slow ball can you actually have? And Tom Curran hasn't got the Xbrex pace to get himself out of trouble.
Yeah, and that, when you boil it all down, is critical, isn't it, to the Tom Curran story. If he just had that extra yard and a half, then it could compensate. As it is, top players, they do, as Joe says, they do wait for him because he's not especially tall. He's not skiddy either. He's the trajectory of a Tom Curran decent length delivery is perfect in one day cricket. You just climb into
it. For the batsman,
yeah, sorry. You just climb into it. And this is where I come back to the 4 day point on him. He shouldn't discard that. And albeit, of course, a modern cricketer's career is not dependent necessarily on their own heart. It's also very much driven by where the money is, understandably so. And I don't have any issue with that. But he said to a journalist friend of ours a few years ago, I looked at it and thought, I want to be the best, the most skillful white ball bowler in the world, which was a laudable thing to say. But it comes with consequences, I think. And that's the concern with Curran, that he'll end up becoming a kind of one-trick pony. And if that starts to fall away a little bit, then you're not left with an enormous amount to fall back on. Mm. But we shall see.
I think it's quite interesting how playing red ball cricket can actually help you in 50-over cricket in particular.
Totally.
I was thinking specifically
Chris Wokes. I was going to bring him up. You're bang on.
One of a number of England players who had a very good World Cup when they won it.
Did we win it?
Yeah, we did win it. But he did so bowling like quite classical new ball spells. And that playing, taking 400, 500 first class wickets must have helped.
And I think this is what's happened a bit with Tom Curran, is that the kind of auto mode seems to be to not get hit rather than to take wickets. And I think that's largely a product of how he's used in T20 and the fact that he's become a death bowler. But he should. England, when he first came through, England would have been thinking he's a bowler who can take wickets with a new ball in 50-over cricket. And now he doesn't really get the new ball. I can't remember the last time he took the new ball in an ODI.
He's taken it a few times. So he did it a few times before Archer played for England.
Right.
He actually did okay opening the bowling. And then he's done it two or three times since then.
But if you're not getting that opportunity with a new ball, the few overs that it's going to do a little bit, and then you come on in the middle overs and you're being targeted as the weak link in the attack, it's a really tricky job he's got.
Mm, definitely. One of the kind of trends of the winter, I guess, has been Indian players doing really well straight away in the international careers. So you've got Natarajan, Siraj, Gill, Saini, Sundar, Akshar Patel, Ishan Kishan, Kunal Pandya and Prasidh Krishna, and Surya Kumar Yadav, who in his second and third games, but his first and second two innings, was absolutely brilliant for India in the T20Is. The 30-year-old Mumbai Indians batsman scored 89 or 48 across his two innings. He's absolutely amazing. Where's he been?
Well, where he's been was the big breakthrough was the IPL last autumn time, and I remember Ian Bishop commentating on a game and saying he is the boy. Trust me, he is the boy. He's a late bloomer for Indian cricket. As you say, he's 30-year-old. He's got a decent record behind him, although not an outstanding record, because often Indian batsmen are averaging 55, 60 in first-class cricket. He averages 45, but he's made, I think, 1,400s from 70-odd games. So he can play. What you see with him is a player who now knows that he's good enough for that level. And that innings was that perfect combination of arrogance and control.
He hooked Jofra Archer for six first ball.
It was a fascinating shot, Matt, because
great reaction from Archer as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Archer just kind of pissed himself. And it was a brilliant moment, because for all that it was spectacularly audacious and so on, there's not any other shot he could have played to the ball. Because if you look at it closely, he's kind of thought, right, Archer, back and across. And then it's there, and it's in at his chest, and he kind of turns his head slightly and crouches slightly, by which point the instincts have taken over and the bat's getting in the way, because otherwise it's taking his shoulder out or his chest out, and he happens to stick it over long off. I'm not saying it's not a great shot.
Did you see what he said after the game about it?
No.
He said he knows that Archer quite often bowls down.
He knew
his
first coming.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think you'd have to, because, I mean, his first movement was anticipating that back and across.
Yeah.
The shot for me was the shot over extra cover for six. I forget who it was again.
Off Rashid, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was Rashid, yeah. Dances down a little bit, keeps in the shot, kind of Damian Martin style. He's not reaching for it. And yeah, sort of 10 rows back. It was an innings that was also beautiful. And whenever you get a beautiful, crazy innings in 20 over cricket, that's always quite memorable, I think.
There was quite a lot of online chatter about Darren Millan again.
Really?
England's most pressing concern, I'm going to put it out there, isn't the bloke who averages 50. But I think his and Butler's partnership highlights how pundits still haven't got talking about T20 cricket quite right yet. Both of them in the last game of the series, despite scoring half centuries, their scoring rate was absolutely miles off the required run rate. You still had commentators, including Atherton, for example, describing Milan's innings as a great one. And it wasn't that kind of that'll show them innings that I think a lot of people made out. And I think that it boils down to, quite simply, just how we talk about and how we record those innings. Because at the moment, we still... A T20 scorecard looks exactly the same as a test match scorecard, but the games are completely different. And I just think that there should be metrics that show how effective a T20 innings are. And they don't have to be things like CricViz's batting impact that does that in a kind of expected goals kind of way, but almost like you have something that says the percentage of balls used and the percentage of runs scored, for example, particularly in a run chase, I think, just to kind of illustrate clearly actually how effective was that.
And presumably the ICC T20i rankings, which Milan is still top of the batting rankings,
yeah, by miles,
don't take that stuff into account at all.
Yeah.
In terms of actual match impacts and having a strike rate that is going to win you a game. And that ranking is often the things that is referred to when he is criticised.
Mm. Anyway, on the series as a whole, Joe, we were saying before we recorded that I don't think that series could have gone worse for England, bizarrely, even though they won two games, because they won two games early in the series. Their plan was to get wins with them sticking to plan A under their belt. But then when it did go wrong, it was too late for them to try other things out. And they don't have that many games before the T20 World Cup. And Owen Morgan has already said that he's not expecting to have a full-strength squad for much of the summer, if at all.
Yeah, well, I completely agree. Basically, that is how it's played out. Morgan, as I said before, he wants to pick his best side whenever he can, and that's been the route they've gone down. But then when you see players like Curran or like Chris Jordan start to lose a bit of form, and then you don't really have the chance to try someone else. Got a feel for, Phil and I were talking about this yesterday, got a feel for Matt Parkinson. I mean, I think he's been with the England squad
the entire winter.
Is that definitely the case?
Definitely the case. He's been there the entire winter. I think he will play in at least one of the games to come.
Well, he won't play tomorrow with the series still on the line. I'd be very surprised if he plays tomorrow. But I'd love it too. And my word, it'd be merciful to give him a game of cricket.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much talk about duty of care. And rightly so. There's so much talk about the mental strain of bubbles, and rightly so. Matt Parkinson's been a net bowler for...
3 months.
3 months?
Yeah.
Well into 3 months now.
And we talk about the strains of playing and the need for rest after that. Well, surely the strains of not playing, just sitting in your hotel room, coming out, bowling in the net, going back to your hotel room, that's got to be the worst of the lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not really on. I think there's a question to be asked there.
And it seems because he's a junior player, he can just do that endlessly. Whereas someone like Joss Butler or Moeen Ali or Johnny Bairstow has a kind of very carefully defined schedule. Parkinson seems to have somehow slipped through the net.
And also, he's not actually... Part of the reason why players were rested, we know, is because of the IPL. But Parkinson's going straight into the county championship season. Like, he might not necessarily play every game in April, but he is going straight from one...
God, if he comes back and he doesn't get picked for the first county championship game, which is potentially very likely, how depressing is that? Really tough time for him. And I think it's worth... I think we should probably bring it up when we speak next time we speak to someone at the ECB, because it does feel like that there's an inconsistency there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Joe, just quickly on what England can do with their bowls. What do you think they can do in the summer? We talked about it a little bit last week, but Tamal Mills, Sakeem Ahmed, David Willey, are those the guys who they should be looking at, you think?
Yeah, Tamal Mills, I mean, is he fit? Currently fit?
He says he is.
Well, absolutely. I'd love to see him play for England again. I think those three are the three that I would look at. I mean, Willie's got an exceptional record. Didn't really deserve to be dropped in the first place. And then I think carried himself really well when he came back into the ODI side. Did brilliantly against...
Player of the series,
Brilliantly against Ireland. I would take a look. I mean, Jordan obviously offers so much in theory. exceptional fielder, can hit big with the bat, and he's been England's most reliable death bowler. And Morgan really backs him. But his form has not been great, and it's been worse in T20 franchises than it has for England.
Well, one thing that I think is a bit of a myth is that Chris Jordan saved his best performances for England. In his last 14...
That's definitely the impression I've got.
Well, in his last 14 T20 games for England, he's gone over 10s in 8 of them, which isn't... I know he bowls to death and that's going to happen sometimes, but that's not a great percentage. He's not had... His numbers for England for a while haven't been great. They are possibly slightly better than his IPL numbers, but still... he's played so much T20I cricket for England. You kind of feel that England aren't going to really go away from the Jordan plan.
Is this kind of
this late into the
almost like a
planning.
Kind of form versus faith thing that goes on with Morgan backing the players that he trusts as long as he possibly can? Because we haven't seen players break into that group, partly because England have been so good. But I mean, other than Jofra Archer, we haven't really seen a kind of bolter come from nowhere for a long time.
Yeah, they did, in fairness, try it for that New Zealand tour after the World Cup. Pat Brown played, Lewis Gregory played, Sakeem Mood, Matt Parkinson. They will play that trip at all. But I guess Brown he's been injured, lost form a little bit. Sakeem Mood, I think, would have been in India had it not been for the PSL. I get that impression that he was England
that was thought better for his
exactly.
Progress,
and to be honest, it was going pretty well.
Which
as
is probably
a
absolutely
taker.
True as well, I think.
I'd expect Sakeem to play come the summer. Before we go on with the rest of the show, we've got some big podcast news. From next week, we have a new regular guest. Mark Butcher will be a regular on the show throughout the summer, swapping the commentary box in Chennai for a seat next to us in our studio. The show's format and structure will remain broadly the same, so don't worry, it won't be too different. Phil, you're actually working closely with Butch on another project.
Yeah, Mark's writing his book, his autobiography this year, this summer. He's got quite a story to tell. And we spent yesterday actually going through it here at the Oval, the first of numerous conversations to take place over the next 6 weeks or so. It's an exciting gig, actually. And we're going to enlist his old man, Alan, the legendary Alan Butcher, and one or two of his teammates as well, hopefully a couple of the Australians, and we're going to base the book around that day at Headingley, and use that as the hook upon which to hang a life, really. And it was lovely yesterday. My moment of the week would have been this, really, that, you know, the sun was out yesterday and there was a little game taking place, an inter-squad game between the Surrey first, seconds, thirds, fourths, a few pretenders in there as well, a couple of young cricketers from the MCC were involved as well, including one lad called Justin Broad, who stole the show with a brilliant sort of 40 or 50 odd, looked the part.
I enjoyed Liam Plunkett bowling just when England were bowling.
Well,
in the
exactly
middle overs.
That was, yeah. I think it might have been Vish who tweeted, penny for Liam Plunkett wherever he is now. And he was right out there with his top knot running in from the pavilion end here at the Oval. And it was just a nice, there was a sort of symmetry to it because Mark was talking about, you know, growing up here, but literally being 3-year-old in the dressing room when Alan was playing, of course, opening the batting for Surrey, and there being a sense of predestination, if you like, that he would end up captaining the club and now he looks back on the place, you know, 50-odd years on or 45, 50 years on and the next intake is still out there. It's early season, and yet there are still players out there hoping for the best, hoping to make their mark. And there's a kind of a sense of the wheel of fortune rolling along, you know. And it was just a nice afternoon to get back into it. The season begins in earnest in 2 weeks from now, on the 8th.
Yeah, 2 weeks tomorrow.
Yeah. And just another little shout-out, actually, for a lad called Harry Phillips, who was in the Essex squad for their two-day game against Lancashire this week. And he's an old teammate of mine. He didn't say a word for 3 years when he was in our dressing room. He threw the odd bat, to be fair. Little kid at the time, left-hand bat, left-arm seamer. He's shot up in the last 2 years and become far too good for our club. And now he's in the Essex squad. So good luck to H. He's one of your own.
You've not said that in a long time in this pod. Elsewhere in international cricket, New Zealand are 2-0 up against Bangladesh in an ODI series in New Zealand. New Zealand are without both Ross Taylor and Kane Williamson for the first time since 2014. Tom Latham is their captain, and he scored an unbeaten 100 in the second game. Afghanistan beat Zimbabwe 3-0 in the T20I series. South Africa women beat India 2-1 in the T20I series in India. Lizelle Lee hit a quick 70 in the first game, as South Africa chased 159. In the second, South Africa comfortably chased down 133. And in the third, India comfortably chased 114. Shefali Verma hit a 30-ball 60 in the third game. I'd very much recommend finding the highlights that are on the BCCI website. They've also found another gun young bat in 17-year-old Rishabh Ghosh, who hit 44 in the second game. And whilst we're talking about the BCCI website, they put up highlights throughout the game, and they put up the moment where Owen Morgan got dropped first ball by Virat Kohli at slip, and then Morgan thought it was caught, so he was kind of wandering out of his crease and was then nearly run out. It's a great clip, but it's been headlined by the BCCI as a brilliant piece of fielding from Virat Kohli, but it's like quite a standard drop catch and then a missed run out opportunity.
So,
depends on your point of view, I guess.
That's true. I thought that was quite amusing. Just on women's cricket in India, reports in India are suggesting that there will not be an expansion of the women's T20 Challenge tournament that's been happening over the last few years. A women's IPL has been promised for a while now, and it's not really happened, which is...
What's the justification?
No, it's just reports at the moment. There's not been an official announcement, so it might still happen, but looking unlikely.
It'll be pretty lamentable if it's nothing more than it was last year, which were essentially a few exhibition games with some vague and unconvincing competition around it. You know, what, 4 or 5 games it was?
And the same as the year before that as well. I mean, I don't know how many exhibitions you can have before you get going with the real thing, really.
There was quite a telling line from Verma actually after she hit a 60, which was, I don't know when I'm next going to play, so I want to make sure that, I wanted to make sure today that it went well. Which is such a shame when it's, what, a year and 2 weeks since they played in front of 87,000 people at the MCG. Some more positive news this week for the English recreational game from March the 29th. Organised outdoor cricket can resume. Outdoor netting is allowed. Changing rooms, etc. remain closed. But as long as there's no bad news in the next few weeks, the club season should begin on time.
Huge news.
And related to people playing cricket, Phil, you want to talk a little bit about the Dynamo's cricket launch.
Just wanted to mention it, really. And for any people involved in clubs or any parents listening to the show or any kids, any 8 to 11-year-olds listening in, sorry for the bad language earlier, if you were. It's simply that the Dynamo's cricket initiative, ECB initiative, that was due to be launched last year and wasn't, for obvious reasons, is launched in earnest this year. And it is the next step from the All-Stars cricket thing. So the All-Stars cricket thing was rolled out with a degree of success initially, and then it deepened and it became more substantial in the last couple of years. All-Stars deals with kids at that entry-level age. Dynamo's deals with kids at the 8 to 11-year-old age, when obviously they're beginning to develop, but they're also beginning to look at other things as well, and beginning to pick and choose what they may or may not be wanting to do with their time. So it's an important juncture in a child's development, and you just need to go on the ECB website basically and read up on it. All clubs worth their salt will be involved with the scheme. There are benefits to the kids and to the parents as well. There's equipment that you can purchase. You essentially buy the program itself, and with that comes an affiliation to the club. There will be a club within your vicinity that will be running this Dynamo scheme. It's a nationwide scheme, and it's designed to bring through kids that invariably won't have had much experience of the game before. So it's a good entry level initiative for those kids, as I say, between the ages of 8 and 11. Just in brackets, the really big challenge will be 4 years down the line when the kids are 14, 15, 16, because that's when data and surveys have showed that that's when kids tend to fall away from the game a lot more. they fall away from a lot of recreational pursuits, but cricket takes its hit with kids at that age. So the next step for the ECB, and I know that they are aware of this, is how do we retain the mid-teen cricketer as well as bring through enthusiasts at the early points.
Mm. Interesting. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So I think we each have our kind of markers that the new season is just around the corner, whether it's kind of the smell of cut grass or linseed oil or that point where you get to that point in the football season where you just don't care anymore. That's always a sign for me that the cricket season is around the corner. But really for me, it's generally when 500 pages of questionnaires from county cricketers arrive on my desk to be proofread for the Cricketers Who's Who, which, Phil, I worked out we have been working on the Cricketers Who's Who for 11 years now.
Oh, 11 years. Joe.
I was editor for a few of those. Benj Moorhead now does that from his mansion in Italy.
His castle.
But I thought I would pick out a few of the highlights from this year's questionnaires.
Before you get to highlights, what is the Who's Who for people who don't?
What is the Who's Who?
Good point. Okay, so it's basically, it's the Who's Who is featuring every county cricketer, male and female, who will be playing this summer with a few team profiles and articles on county cricket thrown in there as well. So it's how you can get to know every county cricketer in the country. So a survey gets sent out to them and then they fill in their questionnaire. If they can be bothered. Thankfully, most can. And then we stick it in a book, which has been going for, I think, 41, 42 years. So Phil and I have only done a quarter of that. As I said, a few highlights from this year's edition. So one, it's official. Wayne Madsen is the best batsman in county cricket, which I knew is good, but this came as news to me. So one of the questions that was asked is the most difficult opponent in county cricket and also, if you could take one shot from any other county cricketer, what would it be? And Madsen came up all the time. The shot was, there was a few different shots, but the main one was the ramp, wasn't it? I think
the Madsen ramp, the Madsen reverse sweep, the Madsen conventional sweep, the Madsen block. The book is just Madsen.
It's amazing. So we used to ask this question and then stopped it because everyone said Marcus Driscothic. Everyone said Driscothic. So it's reintroduced and now it's Wayne Madsen, which is like, I mean, he's obviously a very, very good player, but it's interesting to know what you're kind of his peers think of him, and he's clearly right up there at the top. Other trivia, so there were two Ollie Robinsons in county cricket, the Sussex seamer and the Kent keeper batsman. I found out that they both have the same birthday, remarkably. December the 1st. Both Ollie Robinsons born on December the 1st. I thought this must be an error when I was proofreading it because I thought they'd mixed up the dates, but different years. Sussex 1993, Kent 1998, but both born December the 1st.
Wow.
What are the chances?
Wow. My word. My favourite bit, Chris Dent, Gloucester Supremo, opening bat and captain, newly sporting a beard in recent years, and it changes the look of Chris Dent quite dramatically. And I would know that, 11 years with the Who's Who. And his one of the questions that we were asking was if you could change one rule in the game or one law in the game, what would it be in county cricket or in first class cricket? And he said 5 runs if you hit the stumps at the other end with a straight drive. 5 runs to the batting side if you hit the stumps with a straight drive. I like that idea a lot. I can see no reason why it shouldn't work. I think it adds a little bit of cheekiness to the whole affair. Bowlers will be having to try and stop that delivery as well as kind of, you know, giving a finger to it to try and run out the dude at the other end. And also, having been there myself, when you're struggling for runs and you finally nail one and it just takes those stumps at the other end, that is...
Five's a lot, though.
It's a killer. It's a killer.
To give 5 runs for that. I think there's something in it.
Because 5 is the great sort of enigma number, isn't it, in cricket? And
the equivalent of hitting the helmet.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But actually through skill... this time rather than just
five is a lot.
That's really demoralising for a bowler, especially if it just kind of rolls back from a forward defensive and you're on the floor. Mark Wood's on the floor scrabbling to try and get
okay,
to
okay, well,
it.
We'll have to get Dentsey on the show to find out if he would want those runs to go to the batsman. As an opening bat, you probably would.
You probably would.
You could end up having like a fielder kind of crouched down in front of the stumps to kind of predict it, if it was five runs is a lot.
Now that is something. A very, very straight, silly mid-on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, I like that. That was my highlight from the book.
Anyway, another for you. One of the new questions we asked this year was, what would you do if you were Prime Minister? Haseeb Hameed would ban all roadworks, which is a kind of short-term thinking I think Boris Johnson could get behind, just win a few votes that way.
It makes it seem that he just had a really bad day up to that point. But yeah, road works actually.
Catherine Brunt has the date of all her major career achievements tattooed on her ribs, which, you know, she's been around for a while. That must be quite a busy rib cage that she's got now.
Sorry, was that in answer to what would you do if you were prime minister?
No, sorry, I jumped. I'm not sure what it was in answer to. I think she might have just told us that because she wanted to.
Nice.
Oh, surprising fact. We asked for a surprising fact.
Okay.
And on that theme, surprising fact, finally, Ollie Stone's great-granddad created the Twix.
Really?
No, get out.
Apparently.
Wow.
He doesn't provide any proof or any more detail to that, but yeah.
Wow.
It's a flamboyant lie if it's not true. We'll have to get him on, find out.
And he can bowl 95 miles per hour as well.
Yeah.
What a man. Wonderful. There is also a new Wisden Cricket Monthly out this week.
Oh, yeah.
Joe, what's in it?
Yes. So it is the county issue. It is our preview for the new county season, kicked off by David Hopps, who's written a brilliant essay about why county cricket is more important than ever in the wake of, obviously, a miserable 2020.
And Hopps makes the spine, Joe, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Discover it, nurture it, save it. County cricket has never been more vital. David Hopps, page 30.
Which sums it up. So that kicks it off. We preview all 18 counties. We get all the Wisden writers to pick out what they're looking forward to seeing this summer. Yaz, you're in there. What were you looking forward to seeing this summer?
I basically said that the county championship is slightly more interesting when England aren't doing great. And after three defeats in a row, bitter pressure on some of the batsmen. I always enjoy the kind of hype that builds up around players who have previously never been talked about with England. Players who might never play for England, but there's just that, you know, quite a few journalists start interviewing them, and then every time they get 100, Twitter goes crazy. That's always quite
or
fun.
Or players that journalists have never actually seen, but they string a few scores together, and suddenly they're the answer to England's batting problems.
Yeah, but I find that.
I think we've all been guilty of that one.
Never.
Yeah. Phil, you were looking forward to taking your dad to Chelmsford, weren't you? Was that your thing you're looking forward to? It's quite niche now I say it like that. But
I did write that. I'm writing a book about Essex this summer, and hoping to follow the club around throughout the season, really, and shadow the club, in effect. And my dad took me to Essex in 1980 something when I was a kid, and I'd like to return the favour, really, because he hasn't been for a number of years now. He still loves his cricket, and it would just be nice, I think, to sit there in that imperious tin pot ground at Chelmsford, and you know, and just watch the world drift by with my old man, because that's what we did, and that's what began this ludicrous love affair for me. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to sitting, in effect, with an old man outdoors and watching some cricket.
I think a few of us are looking forward to that. And not too long. We've also picked out a bunch of ones to watch this summer, which I think we'll be doing our own for the podcast, right, Yaz? We've got that lined up.
Yeah, we're going to have a big county championship season preview in a couple of weeks just before the start of the season. Plans for that are not 100% yet in place, but we may be doing something like that.
And Phil goes kind of behind the scenes. I don't know if you can go behind the scenes at the Oval Invincibles when they're not really a thing yet, but you can explain what the piece is about.
Yeah, I decided that I would look at the Oval Invincibles as a case study for the 100. And I've become quite interested in how this thing carves itself up, how it settles down as well, and its relationship with the county club that hosts these 100 games. And the more I asked and the more I got digging, the more interesting it became. I ended up speaking to Tom Moody, who is the head coach of the Invincibles. I spoke to a couple of the players, Laurie Evans and Alex Blake. I also spoke to Georgia Adams, who will be heading up, will be one of the key players for the female iteration of the Invincibles. And I spoke to a couple of people as well within the club, within the Surrey setup. And it's interesting, there's an interesting tension at work there. No question there's a tension at work that the Oval will be de-Surreyfied for the 100. All the branding will be about the Invincibles, and Surrey as an entity will be buried under the rubble of all of that. Surrey are encouraged to get fully behind the tournament. There will be member discounts for Surrey members, you know, for tickets and so on. And so they're encouraged to believe that there is this synergy between county club and 100 franchise. We don't call them franchises, but for shorthand, they're franchises. And yet there is an undeniable tension there as well. 12 of Surrey's first team, and it may well be more by the time it comes around, but a minimum of 12 will not be available to play in the 50-over tournament for Surrey. So they will be wrenched out of their day jobs and embedded into the 100 setup. One or two will also be playing Test cricket, which is another layer of confusion. But it's just an interesting time that this thing, which has been, what, 3 years? You know, in gestation, 3 years now since the idea came about. We still haven't seen a ball of it. We know all about the ups and downs and the rancor around this tournament. We know all about that. But to me, it's interesting that I don't think it will work effectively unless there is full buy-in from the counties as well, and especially from the big counties that will be hosting these games.
What does buy-in right kind of look like? Is that doing their most to make sure that their members turn up, or doing their best to try and sell tickets, or what is it?
Well, this is it. So much, everything's complex. So the ECB has taken centralised the marketing side of the thing and the ticket selling side of the thing. So Surrey were prepared and wanted to sell tickets, and the ECB across the 100 has centralised that process. So they've spent quite a lot of money creating a ticketing system that then, in effect, sidelines the counties. And so this is another tension. This is another imbalance there. That on the one hand, the ECB is saying, this is for all of us. This is for you. This is for us. This is for the counties as well. And on the other, they are, unwittingly or otherwise, sidelining the counties. And so Surrey are not alone in looking at the process and wondering where they come in, what influence they can have on a tournament that will, A, be clearly eating into their own revenue models and their own revenue streams. Unquestionably, Surrey is just an example, right? Surrey have 6 home games in 12 days in the blast, in the T20 blast. Now, even a ground like the Oval, which sells out better than any other ground in the country, is going to be hard-pressed to flog full houses for 6 home games in 12 days. And why do they have that? They have that because of the 100. And we as a cricketing family are also hoping that we get bums on seats for the 100 as well, because if we can unite around one thing, it's we don't want it to be a disaster. If it's a disaster, it's a disaster for the game. If it's a success, then there are still elements of disaster to it being successful, if you were to ask certain counties and fans of counties. But the big point is that there is a palpable tension, I think, between central government, in effect, and the counties that are being asked to throw everything at it, while at the same time feeling like their hands are rather tied behind their back.
It's interesting because I can guarantee you...
This isn't going to get me into trouble at all.
I can guarantee there are a lot of listeners who will struggle to feel sorry for Surrey out of all counties and all this. When the tournament was first announced, the big concern was actually the counties who aren't hosting any cricket during it.
Yeah, I think Surrey are going to manage to struggle through okay. But they are an interesting example because they carry such heft in the game and they have been effectively sort of sidelined at their own venue.
It's important as well. I spoke to somebody at Surrey and they said, look, not that it's necessarily their concern, it's the ECB's concern, but this person said to me, the club, or rather the ground, will sell out pretty well for the 100 games. Central London, work crowds, etc. But he said, can we with any confidence say that about other grounds? Can we say that with any real confidence about Old Trafford, about Edgbaston, about Trent Bridge, etc., etc.? Can we say that with any confidence about Cardiff in particular, where this is the local team of folks down in the cricketing hotbed of Somerset, and it's you got to kind of cross into another country, in effect, over the bridge, and you know it's a two hour trek to get to Cardiff for genuine cricket lovers down in the southwest. So there are all kinds of questions that I think are probably more challenging to answer and justify the further afield you go. The Oval and Surrey and the entity of Oval Invincibles, therefore, is probably more protected by this stuff than any of the other regions. But the stories that I've found out in the last few weeks doing this piece will echo around the game.
What could happen if they don't sell that many tickets. Like, what does a poorly attended tournament look like in terms of repercussions for English cricket as a whole?
I think certainly when it was due to be rolled out last year, they were hoping for something like 50 to 60% attendance, and that was considered to be a reasonably good result. That would have been acceptable. I'd have to find the specific number, but it was around that, 50 to 60. I think it might have been 60. I haven't heard anything since regarding that. I think much of it, and this was something that Laurie Evans in particular, who's played a lot of franchise cricket around the world, said. He said so much of it boils down to perception and what it looks like. This is a TV game. This is a made-for-TV game, but it needs bums on seats to be convincing. It needs people in the ground for it to look successful. And then if the optics appear to be positive and vibrant, then that impression of success will then hopefully, if that's your position, embed itself more into the product itself and then substantiate the product. If you are looking at games of cricket that carry echoes of those sort of, you know, humdrum T20 games when you get 5,000 in and so on, then those questions about why this was created and with its unavoidable bastardizing, if you like, of the T20 tournament, why was this created? Well, those questions become ever harder to answer if there aren't many people in the grounds. But again, it's a made-for-TV show, this. And in the end, it will sink or swim by the numbers that it gets for the TV, for the TV coverage. And of course, it was all priced in. The deal in the first place, the ECB deal with the TV companies, was priced in. And so it's protected up to a point. But that TV deal runs out in 2024. That comes around very, very quickly. There is a lot of scepticism, or rather pessimism is probably a better word, regarding this format's chances of longevity. But we shall see.
Your other bits in the mag? We still going?
Yeah, still going.
Sorry, if I'd rather... No.
We've got, well, the Ian Watmore, ECB chairman Ian Watmore interview that I mentioned last week. That's in there. We've also got an exclusive interview with Rashid Khan about kind of putting Afghanistan on the map, not only as a cricketing nation, but kind of boosting their world reputation. I had a lovely 90-minute chat with New Zealand's John Wright.
Lovely,
about his career as a player and then coaching India. And his time in between as a national sales manager in New Zealand when he got a call from Graham Cowdery at Kent, actually, who recently passed away, to say, we've got a gig going, if you fancy coming and coaching us. And then, what, a couple of years later, he was coaching Laxman, Tendulkar, Dravid, Kumble for India. So he's really, really interesting story. Obviously, he's very much part of IPL and Mumbai Indians and all that stuff now as well. And all our columnists, Isabel Westbury, Elizabeth Ammon back on as county columnist, Andrew Miller, and of course Andy Zaltzman. So loads of reasons to go and pick it up.
Wonderful.
Oh, and Heather Knight as well. Her account of the 2017 World Cup final, which is towards the back of the magazine in the kind of nostalgia fest of the Golden Summers section. But I sat down with her last year and we put the piece together between us, and she ended up taking a lot of control over it. And once she let the handbrake off, it turned into a really quite a beautiful piece, I think. And it's obviously a great document of an amazing moment.
Well, you can head to wisden.com/wisden-cricket-monthly to get yourself either a print or a digital copy or a subscription. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Joe. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week with our new regular guest, Mark Whitchurch.